My name is Michael Moller. I teach systematic theology at the Lutheran Seminary in Philadelphia. Originally, I'm from Germany. I did my graduate work at the University of Leipzig. And I got my PhD in anthropology. What I would like to do today is to look at some possible solutions to the problem that I tried to describe in the last session. And I also want to look at the way Christianity and the way of Western thinking has contributed to the situation in which we find ourselves in. A French philosopher, Carl Amery, has written a book, The End of Providence, in which he blames the ecological disaster mainly on the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he thinks that there are basically four wrong ideas that Christians have that led to the disaster that we face at the end of the 20th century, not only ecologically, but also in regard to global politics, to global economics, and so on. The first is, and that was quite popular also in the environmental movement, this argument, is that the Christians have a wrong idea of God. We would have looked at that if I would have had a session on the text in Genesis 1 and 2, that one of the main arguments that the Bible makes about creation is that although creation is rooted in the creative activity of God, creation is not divine. Creation is merely a work of God, and therefore is radically different from God. And that means then that we do not find any divine aspect as Christians in nature. We don't pray to trees, we don't have holy mountains, and so on. The de-divinization or demythologization of nature, Carl Amery argues, degrades nature to a mere space in which humans live. There is nothing more to it than the space that it provides for human beings. The awe toward nature is lost. We certainly see some remnants of this awe, particularly at a place like Holden, where nature seems to be overwhelming if you go out on a sunny morning and see these mountains. But in the Judeo-Christian tradition, God is not inside of nature, but outside of nature. So that's, he thinks, the first wrong idea. And he would look to other religions that find God much closer involved and participating in nature, for example, Native American religions in this country. The second wrong idea, Carl Amery says, is the wrong idea of history. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, history is understood as going from the beginning to the end. And that is for us almost so normal that we don't even think about that as something that might be wrong or something that might be unusual. We think that history basically moves in a stream from the past through the present to the future. Now, there are other concepts of history that understand it more cyclic, that understand history as a flow of time that does not go from point A to point B, but that flows in circles, so that there's a constant repetition. These worldviews borrow much more ideas from the concept of cycles in nature. We all know that there are food cycles, that there are life cycles. If you observe the four seasons, for example, in nature, you can see that there is plenty of repetition, that there is birth and dying, and then birth and dying again, much more circular. Now, Amery argues that the Judeo-Christian tradition of understanding history as a dynamic process or even progress to something in the future leads to a neglect of the present. We are people who think more about the future than concentrate on the here and now. We have hope, we expect even a new creation, as in the book of Revelation, and that means that everything that is as soon as it is already old. And old has almost a negative connotation. Because as soon as a moment passes, it is already gone, it is already history. The third wrong idea, Amory says, is the understanding of sin and justification. He claims that Christians overestimate sin and thereby put constantly some kind of bad conscience on people because sinfulness is regarded as so powerful and so strongly a determinant of our existence. And then at the same time, that goes along with what he calls an under-descriptiveness of justification. We don't really tell what justification is, how it can change human beings. And the consequence of that for Amory is what he calls the Protestant work ethics, that we constantly are ashamed of ourselves, of our sinfulness, and therefore try very hard to be good people. And work very hard on that. And that means that we understand work as a place of self-realization. And we can see that clearly in the ethic of the Western world, that people are regarded what they work rather than what they are. One of the first questions we ask when we meet people is, what are you doing? What's your profession? Because we think that determines of who these people are. And that has the consequence for the environment that we understand nature as mere material for self-realization. We use the environment as a means by which we can realize ourselves. And then he adds a fourth critique of Christianity, which is probably the most provocative of all, and that he calls the over-excessive ethical demand of Jesus. He claims that the radical demand for love that you can find in the gospel cannot be made into a useful ethical program, and therefore Christians have split their ethics into a private ethics and a public ethics. The private ethics, you know, we regard it as wrong to hate somebody, but in public ethics, we claim that this doesn't work in the real world. It works only in the private community, but not in the work of politics, not in the world of economy, and so on. One example for that, this whole debate, I don't know if that was addressed in the Bible studies on the Sermon on the Mount this week here, the whole debate whether the Sermon of the Mount can really function as a Christian ethic, as a foundation for Christian ethics. And most politicians would argue, no, it can't. It's a nice idea to love your enemy, but I have all the respect for people who do that, but in the real world, we couldn't do that. We couldn't base our foreign policy on the fact that we should love our enemies, but rather that we need to protect our citizens from our enemies or whatever. So these are some pretty radical, tough critiques that Christianity needs to address if it wants to make a meaningful contribution to the environmental crisis. And I think, as I said already yesterday, that we need to rethink our theology of creation, and in that we need to understand what the identity of human beings are, who we are, in order to understand our task for the next millennium in regard to the crisis that we live in. And I would say that there are a couple of things that we can do, but before I go into that, I would like to briefly touch the point of what does our belief in creation mean in the first place? Is it really a workable concept, or is that something that needs to be abolished? According to the critique of Amory, it is certainly something that has created some problems. There are some people in the science field that think that the concept of creation is not working and does not go along with scientific data that they have come up with. I think that when we look at the concept, the Christian concept of creation, that is part of the creed that we all confess if we are Christians, I believe in God the Creator, we have to realize first that the doctrine of creation does not want to make statements about the beginning of the world. That is not the major interest of the creation stories, the creation texts in Genesis 1 and 2, but also in other creation texts, for example, Psalm 8, or even creation texts in the New Testament. When we speak about creation, we don't want to make a statement about the beginning of the world, but we want to make a statement about the meaning of the world. So we do not ask the question, how, for example, how did the world come into being? How did it happen that there is a cosmos? But we want to answer the question, why? Why is there a world? Why are there human beings? Why did God create us? That is quite important to understand, because then you see quite clearly that we are not necessarily in conflict with the way science views the world. Because science is really not interested in the why question. Science is more interested in the how question. Secondly, if you look at all the texts of creation in the most important texts of the Old and New Testament, you can see that Christian and the Judeo-Christian way of speaking of creation does not sanctify one particular worldview. I showed that in detail in my talks about the creation text, that they utilize certain views in their time and at the same time critique them. For example, the view that the world was created by a big fight between the gods and was a product out of that fight. There is even the name of the one god that the Babylonians regarded as part of the reason for the creation, hidden in the text of Genesis 1 by the word Tiamat, which shows up then in the Hebrew Tehom, which means the chaos sea. You know, in the beginning, the chaos water covered the earth. And the word that is used in Hebrew has the same root as this Babylonian god. So the Christian, we don't need to be hung up with one particular worldview. That is very unfortunate in the battle of the creationists, for example, that they believe that a certain worldview is required in order to believe in creation. I do not think that they really deserve the term or the name creationists. They are rather very narrow-minded people that want to push for one particular worldview, and by that they violate already the rule of the Bible that is able to use and criticize at the same time a variety of worldviews. Then the third, it is quite clear that both texts, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, call the creation something good. Christians and Jews have a positive worldview. They do not believe that the world that admittedly is full of suffering and evil is something that is created good. So all the worldviews that come up with some kind of negative interpretation of reality are in conflict with that Judeo-Christian tradition. To reach the fulfillment of God's will that the creation is good is something that the Judeo-Christian tradition expects of the future. So creation at the same time says something about the beginning, about the present, and about the future. And it does not focus exclusively on the beginning, as most people think when we talk about creation. And therefore, we as Christians cannot call the world godless or as something that we should not involve ourselves with. That was a tradition that was debated in the development of Christianity for quite some time. In the early time of Christianity, there was a group called Gnostics that regarded the world as godless, as rather unfortunate reality, and that all we need to be concerned with is to leave this world behind us and to return to God. And you can find this kind of escapism still present in some of the of Christian groups. Or other groups thought that the world is really so much away from God that we need to be at least not too detached to it. Both of these positions do not recognize that the world is a deed of the love of God, which is and which can be enjoyed by human beings. And then the fourth, which is also quite important for the people of Israel, the faith in God the Creator relates to the experience of the Exodus. Both are basically related. Creation is understood as deliverance as much as the Exodus. And therefore, the Exodus motif is as important for the Christian way to look at the world as the creation motif. Now, having said that, what can we then contribute today to the debate on the environmental crisis? I think that one major task of Christian theology and of the Christian religion is to criticize the dominant worldview that is present in the empirical natural science view that is so powerful and surrounds us so powerful. We need to enter a discussion with science about the worldview that it presents as the only possible one. Now that is on the science side already a long tradition which started with Wilhelm von Ockham. Some of you might know him from the very popular novel and movie The Name of the Rose. I don't know if you ever had the chance to read that book or to see the movie with Sean Connery, a book that plays in the medieval times, and it's a very fascinating study. It's a mystery novel written by Umberto Eco, Italian linguist and novelist. It's very fascinating and exciting when it came out about 5 to 10 years ago. It was promised that if you started, you better cancel all the appointments for the weekend or for the next week because you will not stop until you have read the book. It's very fascinating, and it gives you some of the ideas that came up in the Middle Ages about science, and William of Ockham is one of the model characters that is used in the book. He lived already 1285 to 1349, and was called the Doctor Invincibilis, the doctor that nobody could manage to disprove in his opinion. He is the one that some of you might know by the term Occam's Razor from your philosophy. Occam's Razor is a very useful rule that can be used all over whenever you try to think about something. And Occam's Razor basically says, never use more than needed. That's his idea. Something that is quite useful because we tend to use always much more than is needed. That seems to be one flaw of human rationality, that we come up with much more than we really need to solve a problem. He, in the full length of the razor, it says, never use more presumptions, arguments, or conditions than needed for an explanation. So you don't need to make up all these ideas to explain a mere fact, but keep it simple. You know, actually, Bill Clinton's rule it's the economy stupid, that's kind of using the Occam's razor by really bringing everything down to the key question or to the key issue that explains things. From that on, from the Middle Ages on, science became to develop more and more an independent branch of human thinking. Before that, science was mainly done by monks that were trying to explain nature because they wanted to explain the beauty of God's creation. That was the main intention for science throughout the Middle Ages. And out of that came the idea that science could even use independent sources of information in order to explain things, not simply the Bible and theology books. Most present then in the time of Enlightenment that I mentioned before, saying that we don't need God anymore to explain things. That was the height of the empirical worldview that is still very powerful today. In the 20th century, there was some critique from science side whether that worldview really can explain fully reality as it is. Einstein's theory of relativity is a good example for that, that things are not as simple and clear as science wants us to believe. Today, we are even more in a crisis of science. We have, on the one hand, we have the ability to perform and do an enormous amount of things. If you look at medicine, if you look at computers, if you look at information processing, if you look at understanding how matter works and so on. But at the same time, we are in a crisis because people begin to ask two questions. One, is it really good that we are able to do that? And secondly, is there any way that what we can be controlled by interest? In other words, how can we prevent science from being misused for all kinds of purposes? Certainly, there are a lot of science fiction stories out there that draw a pretty grim picture about what could be done with the technology that we have today in medicine, for example, but also in nuclear physics. Nuclear terrorism, for example, is not that far-fetched, thinking that that more and more countries use and are able to develop nuclear power. Now, all this on the one side, we have science now realizing by itself that maybe it is not as absolute as a worldview as it claimed to be. On the other hand, we now have theology that also raises a critique of science, saying you might be able to answer the how question, but you are not able to answer the why question. And in order to understand the world in the way we need to understand it, the why question might be even the more important question to be answered than the how question. And I would even go one step farther and say that theology has to remind science that we need to connect the question of meaning with the question of reality. Because the only other alternative to that would be that we would claim that everything is meaningless. And certainly there are some agnostics out there that would claim that, everything that is a mere result of an accident, that there is no intention that is present in the reality that we face. But that is a relatively few minority of people that believe that. Now, if we believe that there is some kind of intention in our existence, in that we are and that this world is, then we need to debate how we can relate to that intention, how we can relate the why question to the how question. We need to ask the question that already was raised by Karl Heim in 1934, the question, does natural science interpret reality adequately? Or is it dealing only with one dimension of reality, with one dimension of what Karl Heim called the polydimensionality of the world? Now that sounds almost like Star Trek or like science fiction, as if there are many dimensions. What Karl Heim meant, and what I think is a very important point, is that there are more dimensions to reality that need to be understood than merely the fact that we can measure it. And that's the way how science interprets reality, by measuring it. By measuring its size, its temperature, its time, and so on. Is there more to it? Is there something that makes something whole, rather than, and how can we find out that, rather not by measuring its parts, but by getting a perspective of what makes things whole? I give you one example to make it more concrete. Certainly, if a doctor or a biologist would look at your body, she could easily describe how your fingers work, how your liver works, how your heart works, and could tell you if you have trouble with your heart, and so on. Now, let's add a psychologist to that, and he could probably tell you how your brain works and why you have problems getting up in the morning or why you are depressed. He might prescribe you some chemicals that clear up your brain, that help you to process certain things, and so on. But by doing that, by putting the EEG and the EKG on you, and by measuring your temperature, and by weighing you, and by looking at your eyes and whatever, does the doctor really get to know who you are? Certainly, he might be pretty well informed about how you function. But will that give him or her any clue about who you are? What is it that makes you you? Is it something that can be measured, that could be figured out by cutting you into pieces, for example? Probably not. So what is it? It is probably something that needs a much more holistic approach, that needs to see you as a whole person rather than as something that functions in a certain way. Now, that is something that science has a hard time dealing with, because the methodology science uses is not equipped to see things as whole. A. Mueller, a physicist, says that the physicist discovers only physical truths. But truth is more than physical truths. Truth goes beyond that. And therefore we need to look for dimensions of the conscience which go beyond the physical truth that is measurable. He continues in his book on theology of nature, if we want to know what physics is, we need to reach a critical conscience which makes it possible to see the elements of physics on all levels of organization in front of non-physical elements. In other words, in order to get to know whether physics is true or not, we need to step back. We need to step out of physics and need to look at it as a whole. And that means then that science itself needs that corrective that helps people to understand things in a whole rather than in an empirical way, which the term describes it, takes things apart. The same was said by a biologist in different worlds. He describes the world as a garden, and what he says is that by the way we try to figure out things, we have destroyed the garden. He writes in his book, I don't have the title, you know, actually that was an interview that he has given on January 11, 1981 in a radio feature. He said the following: "The garden is destroyed, the paths are trampled upon, most of the inventory is burned, all the species that are gone already, but the secret of the garden remains a secret. Whether it will ever be a garden again, or whether the final destruction has begun, depends on this, that gardeners come which discover the garden incomprehensible." Now, I compared that with the way a child wants to get to understand things. I have a 16-month-old boy and a 5-year-old girl. And the way, you might remember that from your own children or grandchildren or maybe even yourself, the way we first try to figure out things is that we take them apart, that we destroy them. And parents sometimes get upset with their children, saying, you know, I spent like $25 on this car and you just take it apart and destroy it. And now it's useless, because it's easy to take it apart. It's very hard to put it together again. Now, in regard of our understanding of the world, we are acting still like 3-year-old kids that take the world apart, that destroy things, and we are panicking right now because we seem to not be able to put it together again. The garden is destroyed, and whether it will become a garden again depends, John Dahl says, that gardeners come, which discover the garden as incomprehensible. They don't want to understand the garden by taking it apart, but rather understand it by looking at it and enjoying it and seeing it as a whole. So I think that is something that we can contribute in the present debate on the environment. We can argue for looking at the garden and becoming gardeners. And it's, I think, not an accident that if you look at Genesis 2, that creation is described in the book of Genesis as a garden that is planted by God. So that means then that we have to understand and uplift the what Karl Heim calls the polydimensionality of the world that cannot be discovered by taking it apart, that cannot be discovered by putting it into categories and measuring it. It differs extremely from the physical worldview, which understands the world simply as a process of physical events. Creation understands the world as something which becomes whole and total and a unity by the act of creation. That's why we say we believe that God created the world, because that act of God makes everything whole rather than tearing it apart. The biblical texts come very close to that understanding. Hans Odile Steck, an Old Testament scholar, wrote that the main interest, quote, of the biblical text is the tendency to reveal a depth dimension in the present experience and to lay open the basic conditions of world and humanity which were valid throughout time. So the biblical texts do not necessarily, as I said before, want to describe something that happens 100, 1,000, or 1,000,000 years ago, but they want to describe a depth dimension that is present today. That there is more to say about a tree than just its biological and chemical components. And if you look at a tree, I think that we humans have the ability to sense that, that there is some wholesomeness. If you look at nature, if you walk up and take a hike here in Holden, you begin to understand that in order to find meaning in this scenery, you probably should not necessarily only take it apart and understand it as chemical and physical and whatever processes, but you need to see it as a whole. Now, can we translate that directly into into ethics, into something more concrete. All this is highly philosophical, abstract, and you would you might want to claim that it is not of great help for you when you go on with your life. Now, I think it can be, and I want to briefly talk about that in two steps, and then I give you a chance to react to that. I think that if we take that seriously, this understanding of creation as making us help to understand the depths and the wholeness of the reality in which we live, we can influence our lifestyle quite dramatically. And I do that in three steps that I think are quite crucial for a very practical down-to-earth ethics that everybody could participate in. And I try to explain that by describing three pairs of alternatives that we have to face. The first alternative that we have to face is individualism versus community. Now, I don't tell you anything new when I tell you that probably the American culture is the most individualistic culture in the world. There is no other culture that is focused so much on the individual and his or her achievements. Even countries in the Western world, in Western Europe, that have a very similar economic and political system, are not that strong on individualism as the United States, and that of course has to do with the fact that all these countries are much more densely populated, and therefore you can't afford to be as individualistic. Actually, you don't even have the space to have these single houses and then a lot of space in between and then the next one. I think it is quite crucial that we make a very committed decision for community rather than for individualism. I think that there is a growing sense, even in the United States, that we all have to share the burden as well as we have to share the benefits of the society that we live in. But it is very hard to make that step. I think one of the great disappointments of the political scene in the last 2 years in the United States was that people had the expectation that, raised by the way Clinton campaigned in this country, that he would be able to convince people to put community before individualism. And then when he came into power, he wasn't able to do so. And therefore there was this gigantic backlash in the last elections, which I think was more a vote of disappointment than a really constructive vote for the future. Certainly, it is painful to do that. We should not, it doesn't help to draw this wonderful picture that we should all live together nicely, like Rodney King, you know, why can't we all get to live together well? It is something that requires us to give up something. The question is what and how. I raise only a couple of problems that are debated in the United States. Healthcare reform. We all know quite well that something has to be done. But what are we willing to give up for the sake of the community? When it comes to the price tag, we are not willing to make that step. Entitlement programs. Everybody knows that the entitlements cannot go on the way they go on, that there needs to be some reform. In a society in which the aging population is growing, a debate must be possible on how to finance the care of the elderly and social security. But when it comes to the price tag, we hesitate. We are not able and willing to make that commitment. Now, I think that we will be successful in this attempt to focus on community rather than on the individual only if we would be able to convince people that there is something to gain from being in a community. Not only something to give up, but also something to gain. That it can be meaningful to live together in a community. That it can be enriching to be part of the community rather than to be an individual. And I think that the Holden experience is certainly something that helps us to understand that, yes, we give something up. There's no doubt about it, that we give up something when we emerge in the Holden lifestyle, and most people are only able to do that for about 1 week, a year. And then they go back into the real world. And certainly you can't live like you live in Holden for the whole year if you don't live here. But certainly what you might take back from here is that it's worth doing it. It's worth giving up things for the sake of being part of a community. There is more, actually, I think, to gain than to lose. So that's the first one. Second one, the pair here is consumption and fulfillment. Consumption versus fulfillment. I think that we have to learn painfully, and again, this is very strong in the American culture, that consumption does not necessarily make happy, and that fulfillment does not necessarily come from consumption. Although people tell us that all the time, in the media, in the advertisement, that we are what we eat, you know, and that you cannot really be happy if you don't try this branch of cereal. Or that you cannot be truly a good person if you don't spend money on this or on that. That means, that is certainly necessary in an economy that is growth-oriented, because a growth-oriented economic system tries to increase the consumption of the population. People that produce need to sell it, and they need to convince that you really need this thing in order to be happy. Otherwise they wouldn't be able to make a profit out of the product and to provide employment for people. Advertisement, if you look at it, promises to make you a human being by buying a product. That is what I call the consumption trap that we go into. We know, of course, that nobody becomes a better person by driving a BMW, although we would all like maybe to drive a BMW or Mercedes. We know that quite well, but somehow we are not able to translate that into our behavior. We know that our identity, our wholeness, is determined by complex interaction of relations with other people. Our children, our parents, our relatives, our friends, participation in society, that we vote, that we interact with people in the community, participation in faith communities, our churches, and so on. So to become a whole human being is a task that is not, that cannot be accomplished by simply buying something. But therefore we need to find out, where can we find fulfillment? Where can we find something that makes us wholesome? Certainly, we as people of faith should have to say something about that. And I would hope that we would find fulfillment not only in consumption, but also in the way we live. And then the third one is the pair receiving or giving. A consumption-oriented community must, by definition, concentrate on receiving. The more I receive, the more I can consume. But we all know, to a certain extent, that giving can make us much more happy than receiving. Now, if somebody gives you a gift, that certainly makes you happy and is nice. But if you think of how much joy it is to give something away to somebody else, you realize that maybe our concentration on receiving might be not the right way to go. Giving, I think, is the ability of human beings to not see themselves as the center of the universe, but to recognize a fellow human being. And certainly we do that most at ease with our children. We want to give everything to our children because we regard them as so important for our own growth. But certainly there's more to us of being part of the community than our children. Therefore, and I think that all people in the church really need to work very hard on that, I think that giving is not simply benevolence, you know, a nice thing that we do for other people, but giving is something in our self-interest. Somebody who is not able to give is failing her or his humanity. And that includes, by the way, also the ability to receive as well. There are some people that are simply not able to receive, who feel uncomfortable by being given something. We have to relearn the values of community, wholeness, and sharing if we want to address the crisis in our environment. And I think that only this, with these three emphases, we will be able to find a way to contribute and to distribute the limited resources that we have among people that are competing for it. If we will rather emphasize the other side, receiving, consumption, and will not be able to orient ourselves into a community, but rather into our self-interest, the future fight for the resources that are limited will drive us more and more into separation. That's something that I mentioned yesterday, the global tendency into particularism. And if you look at the question of population explosion and the question of the future economic developments in the underdeveloped countries, you will see it's only a question of time that there will be much harder fight for the resources of this world, and that people will not allow us in the Western world to consume as much as we do. Now, this is again a more general way of lifestyle. Now I translate that into wrong beliefs and right beliefs, and I have six of them. That is just an arbitrary list that I put together, and I briefly go through that before we have some discussion. And this then concludes my answer to Karl Amery in the beginning of what whether the Judeo-Christian tradition is responsible for the crisis that we find ourselves in. Partially yes, but partially no. And at the same time, I think that there are resources in the Judeo-Christian community that would help us to address the crisis. First, wrong belief. We tend to believe that human beings are the crown of creation, that we are the highest beings, that we are the best, that we have all the rights to do what we do because we are in control of things. We need to learn from our own tradition as much as from other traditions that all things have value if we believe that they are created by God. And therefore, there needs to be a balance of interest. Human interest cannot be the only value, the only criterion that we argue with. Second wrong belief, nature is a resource for human beings. We almost tend to believe that the world belongs to us, that we own it. The right belief that I find in the Christian tradition, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, is that human beings have a responsibility for the world. They do not own the world, but they are given responsibility for the world. Third wrong belief, and I spoke about that briefly with the pairs, production and consumption create fulfillment. Now, I am not as radical, maybe, to say that production and consumption are evil. Certainly, we need to produce and we need to consume. But I think that we need to learn that production and consumption are only one aspect of human fulfillment. And there are much more ways to find a way to live beyond and beside production and consumption. Fourth wrong belief in the Judeo-Christian Western world is that production and consumption must increase. It's almost a ritual. If you watch the evening news, the Dow Jones, you know, there's always this jingle music and do-do-do, and then comes, you know, and everybody looks, and if the arrow goes up, that's a good sign. If the arrow goes down, then we need to worry. I think that we need to learn that there's a difference between quality and quantity. That to increase and increase and increase might not be necessarily the only economic answer to the question of creating jobs, or of the question of employment, or of profitability of a company. Certainly, a company can make profit by producing more, but looking at quality rather than at quantity might also be a very helpful way to even in an economic sense, not simply in an ecological sense. Fifth wrong belief that we know is wrong, but we still believe it all the time, the way we act anyway, resources are unlimited. We live in a way today that seems to think that we can live like this forever. And it is quite clear that we cannot. We have to understand that our resources are limited, and therefore we need to spend them wisely. We act almost like somebody with a credit card who seems to forget that the bill will come by the end of the month, even though you don't hand over the cash when you buy something, but you still spend when you use your credit card. And the sixth, and that is the most controversial probably, particularly in the American context, governments guarantee the use of resources rather than restrict it. We basically think of the government as a guarantor of private property. That's the way the Western world has set up the government and the political system. But we need to understand that governments need to restrict and regulate the use of resources. If we leave it simply to the individual, there will be no way to consume in a responsible way. We need to have governments that are able to think long-term and that are willing to take political risks for long-term interest rather than only think to the next election in the next 2 or 3 years. I read an interesting article yesterday in an old Newsweek magazine about the suburbs. If you're interested, it's right out there. Can the suburbs be saved? And they pointed to, I think, Portland, Oregon, which has a very strict way of governing the spread of the urban area in Portland. And they use it as an example that restriction must not necessarily only impose on the freedom of the individual, but can greatly enhance the living quality of the whole community. And I think that's only one simple example where long-term planning might be helpful rather than the idea that everybody is entitled to do what he or she wants to do. Okay, I end right here. We have a couple of minutes left. I don't know how much you are in the mood to raise some question and to debate. We are a relatively small group, so it shouldn't be too difficult.
You alluded to it before, but really didn't dwell on much at all, that the, at least in my opinion, that the only ultimate problem the world has is population growth. That no matter what you talk about here, that population keeps growing and growing and growing, we're going to be more and more and more restricted, and we have to lose more and more freedoms. That is the foundation problem for all the ecological problems in the world. I mean, if you double the population, you're going to double the problems, everything else being equal.
Yeah.
If you half the population, it's going to half the problem, everything else being equal. And that is the ultimate problem, really. You didn't argue on that at all.
Well, I wouldn't say it is it's the ultimate problem, but I think that it is one of the greatest problems that we face in the next century.
Is there any way that you can conceive that the population can grow indefinitely? Got to stop.
Yes, and I mean we had last week and at the beginning of this week we had a whole series of Professor Schramm speaking about the population explosion, and the point he made was, there's probably no question about that that the population will double by the middle of the next century. The question we have to ask ourselves is, do we want this to end up in disaster, meaning death by famine, by ecological catastrophe, by wars about resources and so on and so on, or do we want to address this problem in a more rational way? Saying that that we need to stop the population growth, but that creates all kinds of problems. And as you can see in China, China is one of the countries that really has regarded this as one of the main issues of their future, and have put out some quite harsh measures that people regard as violation of human and reproductive rights, and so on and so on. So so there is no easy solution for that.
But that is still the ultimate problem, though. I mean, unless we act today on that, the world's not going to stop at doubling. I mean, to stop the doubling in the middle of the next century, you've got to act today. Because it's like Lady Lake and the Lake. You don't stop that boat on a dime. You shut the engines back, way back, and sort of coast in, finally maneuver, and finally to slow down and stop.
Yes.
But you don't start. You don't say that by the time it doubles, we're going to stop the population growth. It's going to go on way beyond that.
Well, what people believe then is that with the measures that are taken already now and that nations are forced to take, just one simple fact that the population of India in the next 30 years will reach 2 billion. They have now 800 million, so it will more than double. And you know already, I don't know if you have traveled in India, but you know already the desperate situation of people there. So what experts expect is that all kinds of factors, including the slowdown of fertility, will make this explosion stop at the double of the world population. That's what the most optimistic reports think.
What's going to stop it?